you know, we've talked about bits and pieces of this, but I really do believe that talent scarcity is here to stay. I really believe that remote work is going to become an imperative by the workforce, who is going to have a lot of power in that conversation. If you agree with me that those things are true, then there is no choice but for people to think about building a diversified international talent strategy.
Hi, I'm Boaz, founder and CEO of Simply Augmented, and I'm excited that you're tuning in to Shift AI, a show that explores what it takes to thrive and adapt to the changing workplace in the digital age of remote work and AI. In today's episode, I'm thrilled to have David Nielsen as our guest. David is currently the co-founder and CEO of Doxa Talent, an offshore talent agency focused on sourcing high-skilled talent around the world. If you're someone interested in the way that businesses are dealing with finding the very best tech-enabled talent across borders, you're going to love this episode. It's great to have David on our podcast, and we can't wait to learn more from him. Let's get to it. David, super excited to have you on the Shift AI podcast today. This is going to be a fun one.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. This will be great.
So, David, I like to start the show with just a little bit of your background. We've known each other for a long time just because your involvement in EO. When I first met you, you were the president of EO that year that I joined. So that was pretty exciting. You were on the leadership, but you've since gone on and done a bunch of work globally for EO. Your first company was in real estate. And then the next company, Guidant Financial, was a company that was more in the financial services space. And now you've segued to Doxa. You're the CEO, founder, co-founder, and CEO of Doxa Talent. And I'm really excited too, because we at Simply Augmented have been working with you on some of the technology solutions. You've got really, really interesting ideas about the way that talent and AI come together. And so there's a lot to unpack on today's show. Did I get everything right?
I think it's a good introduction, a great place for us to start.
Awesome. Well, one of the things I wonder about is, you know, previous to all of your professional career, when you think back to the early talent that you had as a young person, what was the first job where someone actually gave you money for the work that you did?
Well, I think like a lot of young kids, I had a paper route back when they actually had physical newspapers. But the one that I actually really was what I would call my first real job, I was actually working at Subway, you know, the franchise that sells sandwiches. Yeah. I worked at Subway when I was 15 years old and actually through high school. And it was actually then that I got introduced to franchising and small business. I got a chance to manage 3 stores, Covington, 2 in Maple Valley. It was just a tremendous learning opportunity. Got sort of whet my appetite for business ownership in the first place.
Yeah. Was business a part of your family? What did your parents do for a living? Did you guys talk about business at the dinner table?
Yeah, a little bit. My dad actually was the president of a fresh Christmas tree company. So if you know, back when we were growing up, you go to a Safeway or a Fred Meyer or a, you know, even a Walmart or what have you, you go to the Christmas tree lot and pick up a tree. Many of those came from my dad's business, which was an international fresh Christmas tree company. It was funny because actually I started my second business, Guidant Financial, and years after that, my dad decided to purchase that from the original owners as they were sort of aging out. And so he and I actually became entrepreneurs at very similar times in our lives, but he was always, you know, responsible for running that organization. I got a chance to learn a lot. And even a couple times when I was a kid, he took me on business trips so that I could, you know, effectively sit in the boardroom with him as he was building customer relationships.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So just for the audience that don't know what EO is, and I know that's just a portion of kind of what you've done over the years, but can you explain that organization and the role that you've had in that organization?
Sure. Well, EO is a peer-to-peer learning organization for people who own and have really started businesses. I mean, technically, there are other qualifying factors, but it was really meant for the entrepreneur as a chance for people to learn and grow with like-minded individuals in varying industries across the world. So that is, you know, something I joined in 2005 as an opportunity for me to learn from other entrepreneurs in the area, which is, of course, how we met. But, you know, it's funny, I joined the organization because at the time I started Guidant, I was 24 years old. So I was young, really had no idea what I was doing. And I felt like it was a great opportunity for me to learn from other individuals. And it was really purely a business decision. You know, you fast forward to today, and what I didn't realize is that it would be the greatest source of both personal and professional growth for me over that period of time. And it's become really my tribe, my community. So most of my close personal friends, a lot of the people that I go to for advice and mentorship fall within that organization. And so, you know, for me, I became really passionate about it because I was getting so much, and I found the more that I gave, the more that I received from the experience. So, you know, as you noted, I started to step up into leadership positions, and I think I was president of Seattle in 2012, and today I actually serve on the global board of directors. So get a chance to be part of the organization's, you know, sort of governing team over all of you, which now today serves 18,000 members, and I think somewhere around 70 countries. So
it's interesting you say that, because I have the same experience. My best friends are also from the organization, and I think, you know, meeting folks like you over the years, there's a feeling in the organization of graciousness. And I know that you've been one of those people that really, you know, you're gracious with your time and with your advice. And so I appreciate that about the general ethos. Can you talk a little bit about the transition from Guidant to Doxa? And maybe we can get into a little bit about what Doxa is. I love that origin story, because a lot of Doxa is a product of not really having what you needed in this other business, and it was kind of an interesting origin story. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so well, look, for the backstory, I started in a company called Guidant Financial in 2003, and the business helps new entrepreneurs find capital to start or buy a business, primarily with less than $1 million. And then we provide tax and accounting, payroll, and 401k administration services to these companies as they continue to grow. So it's a really, it was a fun business and one that I enjoyed working in for almost two decades. But you know, you and I are both from Seattle. I sit in Boise, Idaho today, but I lived in Seattle for over 35 years. And from 2010 to 2020, you know, the landscape changed significantly, right? There was this technology boom. Seattle became sort of the second Silicon Valley of all these different unicorns, this really supportive entrepreneurial community and a very small workforce. And so, you know, over the course of that decade, we saw, while we were continuing to grow, that labor was starting to outpace the growth rate. And that's not a sustainable trend. If you flip that to the other side, we also saw that our team members were having to move further out to be able to afford to live or buy homes. And so commute times were creating a situation that I would call just a quality of life issue for people. And so we had to start looking at different alternatives. We actually started by decentralizing the organization and opening up a satellite office in Boise. So we were going to go with this multi-campus sort of strategy. But we also knew that we were going to have to move into lower cost geographies. And we chose to start outsourcing some of the work in our business. Originally, we worked with an agency. I didn't want to go direct because I just didn't feel like I understood that market well enough. So we started working with an agency and just didn't like the experience. You know, philosophically, we were a best place to work multiple times in Seattle. We wanted to pay well. We wanted to provide full benefits. We wanted learning and development to be a crucial part of that. But we also needed strong technology in place so that we could be a flexible employer without compromising data and security. And we just found that the market was really built for either large-scale organizations who had a high volume of repeatable tasks, or these mom-and-pop organizations who just needed a VA, like a jack-of-all-trades, Swiss Army knife to help them with random tasks. And I needed skilled workers. So we started building sort of process and systems on top of this agency that we were working with. But when the pandemic hit, you know, the world got flattened in an instant. Everyone realized at that point, this debate, should we be remote? Should we not? Nobody had a choice. We all went remote. And actually, most companies found that they could be very productive in that environment. But then on the flip side, you had this talent scarcity issue starting to creep in. So long story short, we took the sort of way we onboard and train our people, the way that we teach our leaders to be remote managers, how we think about development in a remote environment, and then the tools and technology and productize that, spun it out, started Doxa, and now we're helping other companies figure out how to tap into new international labor pools, but do it in a way that creates a win for them and the employee, which is something I had not seen done well in the market prior to.
One of the things that I've been reading about, which I think is interesting, is that you have such loyalty within your VIPs, you know, what you call your talent, that there's so much inbound, and you've been able to kind of foster this sense of loyalty in a market where that's not always the case for businesses like yours. How have you done that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I'll just share for people that aren't familiar with the outsourcing industry, the acceptable standard is 50% turnover annually. Okay, so if you think about that, the companies benchmark themselves to say, like, if we can keep people for 2 years, we consider that a success. Well, to me, that's a terrible model. And I think that's because historically, it's, you know, outsourcing has been the work that you don't want to pay for here in the US, and you just want to send it off to a geography and get it done there. And so it's really task dispatching or administrative positions. We wanted to move up into the skilled labor category so we could help people grow businesses with things like software engineers and accountants and things like that. But in order to do that, one, we had to provide them the stability of employment and make sure that they had, you know, great wages, full family benefits, but also invest in career development. So we've got a full L&D team. We work with our clients to make sure that there's visibility into a career path so that there's alignment for that. That gives the VIP a sense of not only community and stability, but a sense that they're going to be able to grow as a professional in the future. And historically, that just has not existed or done well in the industry. And so that's a place that we're changing. So today, about 40% of the people that are coming to work for us are actually being referred by our actual team members. So not only is there, you know, do we have high retention, but we also have, you know, sort of created this unofficial recruiting force within the Philippines.
Yeah, it's like a farm club that is bringing, you know, folks into the fold. Well, that makes perfect sense. I mean, I can see why it's just unusual to have that kind of commitment to the employees, and in turn, you're getting a lot of commitment to your company. So full disclosure, you and I are working together on some AI projects, Simply Augmented and Doxa's working together. And I know that you conceptually, I've been thinking a lot about ways that talent and AI and machines can kind of come together. I love it because, you know, Simply Augmented is about augmenting humans, and you're in the human business. And so can you talk a little bit about how you think about it conceptually and how you think about AI big picture?
Yeah, well, look, early on when, you know, but particularly when ChatGPT came out, because ChatGPT sort of made AI tangible for the broader public, right? And I think, you know, it's forced us to spend a lot more time thinking about what AI looks like in our business long term. I did spend some time looking at sort of what's happened with major technological innovations, you know, over the years, everything from like the printing press, which was in the 1400s, to the light bulb in the 1800s, to television, the internet, social media, IoT, you name it, right? And in most cases, yes, there were industries that were disrupted, but many others were created. And in fact, as a result of each one of those, more jobs were also created. Now, you know, AI probably represents the greatest risk to workers over an undefined period of time. But I just happen to be of the perspective that there still is going to be a need for human interference, and that AI will be an enabler for us to do more, to be more productive. But I don't foresee it eliminating jobs in a widespread fashion per se. So for us, we've been spending a lot of time thinking about, where are there places in our business where we could start to leverage AI to help us be more efficient, to produce more, to increase our capacity? And that's why, of course, we started having conversations with you guys and have started now, you know, making investments in that way.
What has the response been from the VIPs, you know, boots on the ground, as they're getting these superpowers? How has their response been to you?
I think people are still cautiously optimistic. I mean, for us, I mean, we're leveraging it in a lot of different ways, from design to content production, you name it, right? But I think there's still sort of this you're seeing a lot of news around this particular topic. So I think there is this sort of, I mean, maybe a low level anxiety around what does this mean for me in the future? But I think the more that we embrace it as an organization, the more that we show it as an enabling tool, not a destructive tool, I think the more that we'll create believers out of them, and that we'll see greater adoption as we roll out some of these new initiatives.
Yeah, I think that's really, really interesting. You know, I recently had T.A. McCann on the show, And also he was on a panel that I was moderating in Seattle, and we got to talking about Doxa and about Doxicon. And he went last year and had really, really amazing things to say about Doxicon as an experience. And I want to know a little bit about the origin story of Doxicon. Like, how did you think to do this? And then what has that conference become for you? Can you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, so Doxicon, well, let me go back. So I told you the story, how we built our own sort of offshore capability at Guidant. And I used to go back every 6 months to go meet with my team, to break bread with them, to build community, because we know it's so important to that particular culture. Now, today we're in Kenya and Colombia and Kazakhstan and Vietnam and the Philippines, but at the time we were primarily Filipino-based. I used to go back there all the time, and I remember there was a gentleman who's actually an EO member out there who said to me multiple times, hey, look, you should create your own BPO because you guys are doing something so different. I've never seen people come out and visit their teams. And I just thought it was such a fundamental part of who we were. So when we created Doxa, we decided to create Doxicon as a way to sort of catalyze relationships, to build community, to bring both our team members and our clients together for a chance to give back to the community, which is consistent with our purpose of lifting up global communities, to create a day of learning so that we're investing in the education of both our clients and our people to help expand their sort of awareness around sort of cutting edge business practices, tools, techniques, which is why we're bringing you out to speak on AI. And then the third day, it's really around team building and then ending with a celebratory party. So people that are flying out there, we tell our clients, look, you pay for your airfare and your hotel, the rest is on us. And we curate these great experiences. And again, the idea is really anchored around our belief that in a remote world, which we're a fully remote organization and our clients work with our team members remotely, that culture is no longer about fun and about, you know, family. It's really around connection. It's connection to the purpose. It's connection to the leaders. It's connection to the community, but then it's also a connection to the client. And so we are trying to build relationships in all of those different experiences. And the inspiration came from that.
That's one of the things that I'm most excited about. I'll be going this year, and I realize that there's a huge community outreach component to the experience, which I'm really, really excited about checking out. And I think that's something that I also is unique, that that there's real intention behind that. And I think that doesn't go unnoticed. And as I have been working with you guys more closely, I realize that it's not just about this one place, that you've got a vision for lots of other places around the world with different kinds of communities that are untapped. And I've been actually working with some folks in Africa lately, and I know that you've been thinking about Kenya as a place that you're looking at. Can you speak to the way that you see the world and how you see this evolving? It's really interesting.
Yeah. So, well, first of all, I think our purpose is to lift up global communities by creating meaningful work. And that's not limited to one geography. We see lots of opportunities across the world. One thing I've been spending a lot of time thinking about is demography. And have you spent much time looking at or learning about population pyramids?
No.
Okay. So there's this, you know, very, very high level, and I won't spend a lot of time on this, but, you know, if you look at birth rates globally, in fact, I just saw this the other day, the North Korean leader was literally begging people to start having more children because their population is in decline because, you know, after World War II, as, you know, the U.S. government started to sort of open up waters for trade across, you know, the different countries, people started moving away from the farms and into these industrial centers. And as a result of that, when you're on the farm, you have lots of kids because those kids are free labor. But once you start moving into the cities, you start having fewer and fewer because they become more of an expense. And so if you look at birth rates across the world since 1950, they are almost across the board in decline. And so what ends up happening is you have these population pyramids, and a healthy population pyramid looks like a really wide triangle, right? You have this aging workforce, but you have a younger, more vibrant and larger workforce coming behind it. But if you look at most first world countries today, they are either pillar organizations or they're actually inverted pyramids, which means that the economic growth is nearly impossible long-term. And this talent scarcity issue that people think are magically going to go away is actually not. You know, I've been looking a lot at population pyramids. You know, you've got these rapid growth population triangles, or you have more stable environments, and then you have declining environments. And really, if you look across the major continents in the world, the only one that shows hyper growth potential is Africa. So I do see Africa as a really interesting and strategic place to be. The thing is that there is so much more that goes into choosing a geography than just that: currency, inflation, employee costs, infrastructure, education, English proficiency, natural disasters, connectivity, the long-term demography, certainly, and even is a place that you want to go or feel safe going. And so we've been looking at a lot of places around the world and trying to predict where is there going to be growth for the coming decades that we can tap into from an employment standpoint, but still also check the boxes on all these other issues. So Kenya is one that we've been testing into and that we've seen some real promise in. Colombia is a place where we've opened up operations, and we're also in Vietnam. So we see some exciting potential there and certainly other places around the world.
And now, before we dive deeper, I want to take a quick moment and tell you a little bit about one of our podcast partners. As a listener of this show, I know you're trying to stay on top of all things AI and tech, which is why you have to check out the amazing GeekWire podcast, produced by GeekWire and hosted by Todd Bishop. It's a treasure of insights featuring industry leaders and the latest tech trends that are shaping our world, and the perfect companion podcast to Shift AI. GeekWire podcast is where technology meets curiosity and covers the world of technology, startups, and geek culture. Expand your tech horizons and join the conversation. Tune into the GeekWire podcast today, a perfect complement to our own discussions here. Don't miss out. Follow the GeekWire podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite listening app. Now back to the episode. It's so fascinating. Your business is interesting because as you think about AI and machine learning and the job displacement that may happen, the shifting of expertise to other kinds of jobs, and then also the flattening of the world, like all those things coming together. I mean, it's really hard to think about the future without taking those things into consideration.
Yeah, like I always talk about the future of work as really being one, there's the talent scarcity issue, right? And that's going to be here to stay. Then there's the work, sort of the workspace debate. And this is where, you know, right now, I mean, if you look at the tension between employers, you know, in 2010, only about, I don't know, 18-20% of people wanted to work remotely. Well, today it's 70%. And yet I just saw this this situation where 50% of companies want workers back in the office 5 days a week. And yet I just ran a survey on my LinkedIn profile and it was all but 4% that responded to this. And it was hundreds of people. Only 4% actually wanted to work in an office. So there's this tension between the two. So there's the talent scarcity issue, the workspace issue. And if you believe talent is scarce, which I believe it is and will continue to be, and that remote work is here to stay, then tapping into new international labor pools is important. And then the fourth pillar is really how do you build culture in a remote environment? And, you know, in the traditional office environment, I think people rely on osmosis as a way to sort of transfer knowledge and how to build culture. In a remote environment, you can't be sloppy and you have to be a lot more sort of disciplined about that. And culture is more about connection to the purpose, the leaders, the communities, the client, not about just, do you have a ping pong table and a you know, a beer bong in the back?
Yeah. Can we get into that a little bit? When I was at Meta, we had a team in London. They were in Los Angeles, Bay Area, and Seattle. It was really, really hard for all of us to stay connected. We tried, you know, on video calls, but And they tried to with different activities. You know, there was moments where, you know, we tried to have fun and happy hours, but it's still really, really hard. What have you learned? And maybe share with the audience a little bit about how they should think about bringing people together, culture in a remote workforce.
Yeah, so I think there are lots of people who want to work in a remote environment, and there are a lot of people who want to be in an office. The key is to be really clear about who you are. My concern with the hybrid environment, I think a lot of people are trying to sort of cater to both sides. But by being a hybrid environment, you actually are doing both, but you can't be best in class in either. You pay for both and you have to do both, but you really aren't clear on who you are. So I always tell people, be very clear about your value proposition. Post-COVID, there's like, I remember reading a McKinsey report, there's five new personas that emerged post-COVID. The things that were important to each one of those was very different. So you got to be really clear about who it is you're targeting, what it is you provide so that you can attract the right people into your organization. I think one of the reasons why we've been successful in retaining such a high level of people is because in the outsourcing world, very few companies are remote and also physically employ people, but my average worker is spending 520 hours less on the road. That's 21 full days more with their family as a result of us being a remote employer. And so for some of our team members, that's really, really exciting. But for others, they're not. So I think one thing is be very clear and then be very intentional. For us in a remote environment, we've just had to build practices that help to build community. So like, for example, every month I write a CEO letter to the entire organization talking about how we've performed, calling out people who are living our values. And there's always some sort of element of fun built into that. We do a quarterly all company, all hands call. Every month we're doing leadership team coffees just to build relationships with each other. Twice a year, we get people together once in the summer for what we call a family barbecue town hall kind of thing. And then we do DoxaCon in January. So we're building rhythms in there that are trying to help catalyze relationships. But in an office environment, I think fun is how people define culture. In a remote environment, to me, it's about connection.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, I'll go back to, you know, what I said before about some of the culture that you've created that's generated a lot of loyalty and a lot of people that want to work for you. And I want to kind of introduce the teaser of some of the AI that we've been working with you on. And part of the problem that you had was so much inbound of people that are sending you resumes, so much so that the team couldn't process all of them. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the AI tool that we're going to be announcing in Manila pretty soon here in a few weeks.
Yeah, well, let me define the problem. I think that's the part that is probably the thing that people really get is, you know, so we are in the business of helping companies to find qualified talent for specific full-time roles that they need to fill. So, you know, we're not task dispatching or outsourcing specific outcomes. It's if you need a great software engineer or a great accountant or someone in a sales development role, we go out and find someone specifically suited for that. So I don't have a bunch of people burning a hole in my pocket that I want to push into your business that we hope fits. We actually go specifically looking for that individual. So as a result, we get a tremendous amount of job orders from our clients saying, hey, we want to fill these roles. And then we're out trying to find candidates. To your point, and this is a positive problem, you know, this year we've had to process over 60,000 applications. Like, that's a lot. And we were struggling with, hey, look, if I am trying to find you a great accountant and I get 500 applicants in day one, how are we going to ever sort through those and give them the time and the attention and find really those diamonds in that pile without deploying just a huge amount of human capital, which also has, errors and other issues associated with it, not also including cost. That being said, when you and I got on the phone, we started talking about this. That was where the light bulb went off for me. So what we started to develop with your team was a way to filter those resumes to those that best match the actual job description. So instead of trying to go through 100 applicants, we're spending our time with the 10 or 15 that have the greatest chance of being an appropriate placement. And so, this is something we're going to launch for commercial purposes in January, but we've been testing it side by side our people, and we're seeing tremendous results in terms of making sure that we're dedicating the time and energy to the right applicants.
Yeah, it's super exciting. The testing and the evaluation so far is looking amazing, and I'm really, really excited to launch it. So one of the questions I ask folks, and I think it's really meaningful for a lot of guests that come on the show, is to think back about individuals that really impacted them through their career, mentors that had a huge influence on their lives. Who are those people for you?
Instantly, there are three people that come to mind for me. One is Dave Parker, who you may know locally in Seattle. Another is Stephen Roche. And then in the final is a gentleman named Lex Cisney. So Dave Parker was an early board member for us at Guidant Financial. Again, I was 24, 25 years old when we started the business. And I was looking for someone who could sort of help mentor me along. And he was one of those early people that invested a lot in sort of our in helping us to define our go-to-market strategy and thinking about how we deal with both acquiring and serving our customers, helped us from a board, sort of developing our board and our board governance practices. So for me, that was really foundational at a very early point in my career. And he's someone that, you know, over time I developed a great friendship with, and I still call on occasion when I'm struggling with something. I always appreciate the perspective he brings and how he thinks through the lens of frameworks. Stephen Roche, actually, we hired, he used to be the general manager of ShareBuilder 401k. We hired him actually to replace me. So I was looking for someone who could bring sort of more of the big business, sort of more rigid practices and operational excellence to the organization. And I just knew that wasn't going to be me. So we went on the hunt for someone that could replace me. And we hired Stephen Roche in early 2008. So, or sorry, 2007. And so unfortunately, 2008 happened, and he at that point looked at me and my co-founder and said, hey, look, guys, there's, you know, the world is changing every single day. We need to reduce expenses, and I'm not a founder. So let's just, you know, let's just call it what it is. So he was really gracious about stepping out of the organization. He remained a board member, and then he went on to actually be the COO of, at the time it was Cascade Capital, which is Bill and Melinda Gates' investment manager, and then became the CEO of the Walton Foundation, so, or the family office there, and so Walton Enterprises. And he's just, you know, the thing I appreciate about him is he's seen wild success, and yet he's still the same sort of very approachable, very thoughtful, very humble leader, but very smart, very decisive, very strategic. And so he's someone that early on not only helped to bring some operational excellence, that chops that we didn't have at Guidant at the time, but also helped us to invest in technology that would be an enabler for the business long-term. And so I've got a tremendous amount of gratitude for that. And the final one is just Lex Cisney. Lex is a business coach, actually, who wrote Organizational Physics and Design to Scale. He's someone that I hired to sort of help coach me and my business partner years ago. And the thing I loved about him is he uses the science of physics to grow a business. And one thing that was really helpful for me is to be understanding how I showed up every day and how my energy impacted the people around me. And there's a connection between that and Stephen Roche, because Stephen Roche was in the awkward position of giving me a review, and we elevated him to CEO. And at that point, I was the, you know, I was, me and my business partner owned the entire company. He was the CEO, and yet he was giving me a review. And I remember in it, he said, you know, Dave, you have the energy to lift up a city or bring it to its knees. And I didn't really fully understand that until I met with Lex, and Lex really sort of helped put that in perspective. And so I think, you know, foundational stuff from Parker and the what I would call the sort of operational excellence and technology investments from Steven, and then just the self-awareness from Lex have been things I really appreciate.
Yeah. Great group. Great group. Well, the last question I have for you is one I ask everybody. If you were to think about the future of work, and your business is so tied into the future of work, if you were to describe that in two words, what would those two words be? And then you can elaborate.
So it is international, and it's connected. So, you know, we've talked about bits and pieces of this, but I really do believe that talent scarcity is here to stay. I really believe that remote work is going to become an imperative by the workforce, who is going to have a lot of power in that conversation. And so, you know, if you agree with me that those things are true, then there is no choice but for people to think about building a diversified international talent strategy. So I think international is one. But in that remote environment, as you described, when you're in disconnected, whether you have a campus strategy or full remote, like when you're disconnected, how you stay connected is going to be really important to maintaining, you know, reducing attrition and maintaining loyalty and productivity along that path. And so I think those two are things that us as business leaders have to have in our sights.
Well, David, I really appreciate you being on the show today. There's so much about what you're doing that is so current, given what's happened to us in the pandemic and the fact that everybody in the world all of a sudden went remote. And in this last year, what's happening with AI and machines and humans. There's so much to unpack, and I really enjoyed talking with you. So thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. Such a pleasure to have David as our guest on today's episode.
David's knowledge and experience sourcing talent from around the globe, and his vision for helping businesses compete in a flat, ever-changing business environment is unparalleled. If you want to learn more about David, you can find him on LinkedIn and Twitter, and at doxatalent.com. If you are interested in how he thinks about AI and a tech-enabled workforce, definitely connect with him and keep up with his posts and activities online. I continue to be amazed by the guests we've had on the show, and I'm excited about the ones joining us in the near future. I truly appreciate you spending your time with us. Thank you for listening to this episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Shift AI podcast for more exciting interviews, and to the Simply AI weekly newsletter for updates on how AI can help you scale your business.